Welcome to Nobel Conversations. In this episode, Josh Angrist and Hito Imbens sit down with Isaiah Andrews to discuss how the field of econometrics is evolving.
So, Hito and Josh, you're both pioneers in developing tools for empirical research in economics. And so I'd like to explore sort of where you feel like the field is heading, sort of economics, econometrics, the whole thing. To start, I'd be interested to hear about whether you feel like the sort of the way in which the local average treatment effects framework sort of took hold has any lessons for how new empirical methods in economics develop and spread, or how they should.
Oh, that's a good question. You go first.
I think the important thing is to come up with the good convincing cases where the questions are clear and where kind of the methods apply in general. So one thing I looking back at the subsequent literature, so I really liked the regression discontinuity literature, where there were clearly a bunch of really convincing examples, and that allowed people to kind of think more clearly, look harder at the methodological questions. Kind of there were clear applications that then allow you to kind of think about, well, do this type of assumptions seem reasonable here? What kind of things do we not like in these in the early papers? How can we improve things? So having clear applications motivating these literatures, I think, is very helpful.
I'm glad you mentioned the regression discontinuity, Hito. I think there's a lot of complementarity between IV and RD, instrumental variables and regression discontinuity, and a lot of the econometric applications of regression discontinuity are what used to be called fuzzy RD, where, you know, it's not discrete or deterministic at the cutoff, but just a change in rates or intensity, and the late framework helps us understand those applications and gives us a clear interpretation for, say, something like in my paper with Victor Levy, where we use Maimonides' rule, the class size cutoffs. You know, what are you getting there? So, you know, of course, you can answer that question with a linear constant effects model, but it turns out we're not limited to that, and RD is still very powerful and illuminating. Even when, you know, the correlation between the cutoff and the variable of interest, in this case class size, is partial, maybe even not that strong. So there was definitely a kind of a parallel development. And it's also interesting, I know nobody talked about regression discontinuity designs when we were in graduate school. It was something that other social scientists were interested in, and that kind of grew up alongside the late framework, and we've both done work on both applications and methods there, and it's been very exciting to see that kind of develop and become so important. It's part of a general evolution, I think, towards, you know, credible identification strategies, causal effects, less, you know, making econometrics more about causal questions than about models. In terms of the future, I think one thing that LATE has helped facilitate is a move towards more creative randomized trials where, you know, there's something of interest. It's not possible or straightforward to simply turn it off or on, but you can encourage it or discourage it. So you subsidize schooling with financial aid, for example. So now we have a whole framework for interpreting that. And it kind of opens the doors to randomized trials of things that maybe would, you know, not have seemed possible before. We've used that a lot in the work we do on schools in the Blueprint Lab at MIT. We're exploiting random assignment in very creative ways, I think.
Related to that, do you see sort of particular factors that make for useful research in econometrics? You've alluded to it having a clear connection to problems that are actually coming up in empirical practice is often a good idea.
Isn't it always a good idea? I often find myself sitting in an econometrics theory seminar, say the Harvard MIT seminar, and I'm thinking, what problem is this guy solving? Who has this problem? Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes there's an embarrassing silence if I ask, or there might be a fairly contrived scenario. I want to see where the tool is useful. There are some purely foundational tools. I do take the point. You know, there are people who are working on conceptual foundations of, you know, becomes more like mathematical statistics. I mean, I remember an early example of that I struggled to understand was the idea of stochastic equicontinuity, which one of my thesis advisors, Whitney Newey, was using to great effect. And, you know, I was trying to understand that. And there isn't really, it's really foundational. It's not, but an application that's driving that, at least not immediately. But most things are not like that. And so there should be a problem. And I think it's on the seller of that sort of thing, you know, because there's opportunity cost to time and attention and effort to understand things to, you know, it's on the seller to say, hey, I'm solving this problem, and here's a set of results that show that it's useful, and here's some insight that I get.
As you said, Josh, right, sort of there's been a move in the direction of thinking more about causality in economics and empirical work in economics. Any consequences of sort of the spread of that view that surprised you, or anything that you view as downsides of sort of the way that empirical economics has gone?
Sometimes I see somebody does IV and they get a result which seems implausibly large. Mm-hmm. That's the usual case. Mm-hmm. So it might be, you know, an extraordinarily large causal effect of some relatively minor intervention, which was randomized, or for which you could make a case that, mm-hmm. that there's a good design. Mm-hmm. And then when I see that, and, you know, I think, you know, it's very hard for me to believe that this relatively minor intervention has such a large effect. Mm-hmm. The author will sometimes resort to the local average treatment effects theorem and say, well, these compliers, you know, they're special in some way. And, you know, they just benefit extraordinarily from this intervention. And I'm reluctant to take that at face value. I think, you know, often when effects are too big, it's because the exclusion restriction is failing. So you don't really have the right endogenous variable to scale that result. And so I'm not too happy to see, you know, just sort of a generic heterogeneity argument being used to excuse something that I think might be a deeper problem.
I think it played somewhat of an unfortunate role in the discussions kind of between reduced form and structural approaches, where I feel that wasn't quite right. The instrumental variables assumptions are at the core structural assumptions right. about behavior. They were coming from economic thinking about the economic behavior of agents, and it's somehow it got pushed in a direction that I think wasn't really very helpful. It, you know, the way I think initially we wrote things up, it was describing what was happening. There was a set of methods people were using. Mm-hmm. We clarified what those methods were doing in a way that I think contained a fair amount of insight. Mm-hmm. But it somehow got pushed into a corner that I don't think was necessarily very helpful.
I mean, just the language of reduced form versus structural, I find kind of funny in the sense that the local average treatment effect model, right, the potential outcomes model, is a non-parametric structural model, if you want to think about it, as you sort of suggested, Hito. So there's something a little funny about putting these two things in opposition when...
Yes. Well, that language, of course, comes from the simultaneous equations framework that we inherited. Mm-hmm. It has the advantage that people seem to know what you mean when you use it, but it might be that people are hearing different people are hearing different things.
Yeah, I think reduced form has sort of become used a little bit in a pejorative
sometimes.
Way, which is not really quite what it was originally intended for.
I guess something else that strikes me in thinking about the effects of the local average treatment effects framework is that often folks will appeal to a local average treatment effects intuition for settings well beyond ones where any sort of formal result has actually been established. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, given all the work that you guys did to, you know, establish late results in different settings, I'm curious, any thoughts on that?
You know, I think there's going to be a lot of cases where the intuition does get you some distance, but it's going to be somewhat limited, and establishing formal results there may be a little tricky, and they may only work in special circumstances, and you need to, and you end up with a lot of formality that may not quite capture the intuition. Sometimes I'm somewhat uneasy with them, and they're not necessarily the papers I would want to write. But I do think the intuition often does capture part of the problem. And I think in some sense we were kind of very fortunate there in the way the late paper got handled at the journals, that actually the editor made it much shorter. And that allowed us to kind of focus on very clear, crisp results, where if you... And you know, this is a somewhat unfortunate tendency in the econometrics literature of having the papers.
Well, you should be able to fix that, man.
I'm trying to fix that. But I think this is an example where it's sort of very clear that having it be short.
You should impose that no paper can be longer than the late paper.
That may be very.
At least no theory. No theory paper.
I think. You know, I'm trying very hard to get the papers to be shorter, and I think that there is a lot of value to that, because it's often the second part of the paper that doesn't actually get you much further in understanding things, but it does make things much harder to read, and it sort of goes back to how I think econometrics should be done. You should focus on, it should be reasonably close to empirical problems. They should be very clear problems, but then often the theory doesn't need to be quite so long.
Yeah.
I think there things have gone a little off track.
A relatively recent change has been a seeming big increase in demand for people with sort of econometrics, causal effect estimation skills in the tech sector. I'm interested, either of you have thoughts on sort of how that's gonna interact with the development of empirical methods or empirical research in economics going forward, sort of?
Well, there's sort of a meta point, which is there's this new kind of employer, the Amazons and the Uber and the TripAdvisor world. And I think that's great, and I'd like to tell my students about that. You know, especially at MIT, we have a lot of computer science majors. That's our biggest major. And I try to seduce some of those folks into economics by saying, you can go work for these, companies that people are very keen to work for because the work seems exciting. That the skills that you get in econometrics are as good or better than any competing discipline has to offer. So you should at least take some econometrics and some econ. I did a fun project with Uber on labor supply of Uber drivers, and it was very, very exciting to be part of that. Plus, I got to drive for Uber for a while, and I thought that was fun, too. I did not make enough that I was tempted to give up my MIT job, but I enjoyed the experience. I see a potential challenge to our model of graduate education here, which is if we're training people to go work at Amazon, it's not clear why, we should be paying graduate stipends for that. Why should the taxpayer effectively be subsidizing that? Our graduate education in the U.S. is generously subsidized, even in private universities. It's ultimately, there's a lot of public money there. And I think the traditional rationale for that is, we were training educators and scholars, and there's a great externality from the work that we do. It's either the research externality or a teaching externality. But, if many of our students are going to work in the private sector, that's fine. But maybe their employers should pay for that.
I mean, it's so different from people working for consulting firms. I mean, it's not clear to me that the number of jobs in academics has changed. It's just that
I feel like this is a growing sector, whereas consulting... You're right to raise that. It might be the same for consulting, but this, I'm placing more and more students in these businesses, so it's on my mind in a way that I've sort of, not been attentive to consulting jobs. Consulting was always important. And I think also there's some movement from consulting back into research. It's a little more fluid. A lot of the work in both domains, I have to say, it's not really different, but you know, people who are working in the tech sector are doing things that are potentially of scientific interest, but mostly it's hidden. Then you really, I have to say, you know, why is the government paying for this?
Yeah, although, yeah, I mean, to Hito's point, I guess there's a data question here of, it has the sort of total for-profit sector employment of econ PhD program graduates increased, or has it just been a substitution from finance and consulting towards tech?
I may be reacting to something that's not really happening.
So I've actually done some work with some of these tech companies. I don't disagree with Josh's point that we need to think a little bit about the funding model and who's in the end paying for the graduate education. But from a scientific perspective, not only do these places have great data, and nowadays they tend to be very careful with that for privacy reasons, but they also have great questions. I find it very inspiring kind of to listen to the people there and kind of see what kind of questions they have. And often they're questions that also come up outside of these companies. I have a couple of papers with Wright and Chetty and Susan Athey, kind of where we look at ways of combining experimental data and observational data. And kind of there, Chetty was interested in what is the effect of early childhood programs on outcomes later in life, not just kind of on test scores, but on earnings and stuff. And kind of we developed methods that would help you shed light on that under some in some settings. And the same problems came up kind of in these tech company settings. And so from my perspective, it's the same kind of as talking to people doing empirical work. I try to kind of look at these specific problems and then try to come up with more general problems, for reformulating the problems at a higher level so that I can think about solutions that work in a range of settings. And so from that perspective, the interactions with the tech companies are just very valuable and very useful. Mm-hmm. And you know, we do have students now doing internships there and then coming back and writing more interesting theses as a result of their experiences there.
If you'd like to watch more Nobel Conversations, click here. Or if you'd like to learn more about econometrics, check out Josh's Mastering Econometrics series. If you'd like to learn more about Hito, Josh, and Isaiah, check out the links in the description.